Assalamu alaikum, hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Retail Remix Stories powered by Find. This is your place to get up close and personal with business leaders who are not just building cutting edge businesses, but through their massively transformative purpose, are building and shaping the future of tomorrow. Our guest today is a person I deeply admire for her sense of purpose and for her kindness. Please welcome Erica Blazovich Doyle.
Did I say that right? good attempt. Erica Doyle is fine.
No, I thought I should at least know your maiden name. So,
but it's good. Yeah, good effort. Well done. And you've done a really good job.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Erica. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, truly.
So here we're talking about stories, right? And the right way to start probably would be once upon a time in Lithuania, there was a little girl called Erica. Yeah. So all of us know you from the business side, from the professional side of things.
Yes.
But help us understand what your childhood was like. You know, I understand that Lithuania was going through, it was just a new country at that point in time.
Yeah.
What is growing up like? Was it a very patriotic space to be because it was a new independent state? Or, and what was the atmosphere like? What did you learn?
Good question. And it's interesting because we've known each other for a long time through business and we were in the same space, right? And I think it's interesting to actually get to know people's deep stories. Look, I think my childhood was, in one side, nothing extraordinary, but there are some things that I've learned as I've grown up that I think they were pretty extraordinary. So, you know, I was born in 1988 in then occupied Lithuania, and we got independent in 1991. And so I technically grew up in an independent Lithuania. And when we joined the European Union in 2005, I was 16 years old. And that felt like the world just opened up to us. You know, we joined NATO in 2004. And then in 2005, when the borders opened up for us young people to go and study, to work, it felt freeing. And all of a sudden, the world became smaller and more accessible for us. So I left Lithuania when I was 16 years old. I finished my 10th grade in Lithuania, and I decided that I was going to move abroad and study. And you know, I think, again, this is, I don't believe in going on these deep exploration journeys within, or, but as we get older, I think we learn things, you know. As we get older, we start to see our parents in a different way. We start appreciating their challenges that they had when they were our age, right? Yes. And when they had children. So as I'm getting older and my own children are growing up, I'm starting to realize something that I think I was always very, very incredibly persistent. And somebody shared with me last year a saying that if the answer is no, it means you're asking the wrong person or you're asking the wrong question.
Wow.
And I feel like I have lived by that notion from probably the 5 years old, and my mum would validate that, you know.
Right.
I would never take no for an answer, and I was forever negotiating with everyone and everything. I knew what I wanted, and there was just no way not getting what I wanted. So, you know, when you know my story better in terms of like when I moved, etc. But when I decided that I was moving to England at the age of 16, I was moving to England. My parents were not going to stop me. My school were not going to stop me. And I have children. And if my 16-year-old, at that point, 15-year-old, came to me and said, I'm moving countries. I'm going 2,500 kilometers away from you. I just wouldn't accept it. Yeah. But my parents, by that point, probably knew me better. And, you know, my mom had stopped fighting me and my ways as a child long before that. And she adopted an approach of how do I, instead of fighting her, how do I enable her?
Right.
So instead of fighting what I was going to do, so, you know, if I wanted to change something in school canteen, she would not tell me not to do it. She would help me to do it. She would drive me to the capital to go and stand outside the Ministry of Education and try to catch the Minister of Education. I mean, because I genuinely believed
that you could do the change, right?
You know, and my parents never told me that I couldn't. Wow. I mean, they would tell me, it probably might not happen, but as long as you're aware of it, the worst thing that will happen is you'll try and it won't happen. But you will have tried. So you're going to go to bed restful, peaceful, thinking, well, I've tried, you know, and maybe tomorrow I'll have a different idea. Maybe going and standing outside of a Ministry of Education trying to prove my point on a school canteen wasn't the right way.
Right.
Maybe I had to write an email. Maybe I had to do something different, right? So I was very persistent. I was very, I don't think stubborn is the right word, because stubborn has kind of a negative connotation.
Yes.
But I knew what I wanted. And I genuinely always believed that I can achieve and do anything.
Right.
And we were never, neither me or my sister or my parents, we were never scared of failure. I don't think that that vocabulary even existed in our family, you know. My parents always had, we were very simple working class family. My parents often had two jobs to maintain the roof overhead, to send us to a good school. But my mom always had these side hustles where she was either selling Tupperware or Amway products, or, you know, we were growing cucumbers in our balcony, and then me and my sister would be selling them downstairs by the supermarket, cheaper than the supermarket was selling.
Okay.
You know, my dad would always be, I don't know, buying, selling cars. I don't think as a family we ever held on to a family car for more than 2 months, because my dad would buy something, fix it up, sell it, you know. So we were always hustling as a family in whatever way you look at it, you know. Me and my sister, we would always be trading clothes with our friends, because we didn't have the money to forever buy new clothes. But as young girls, we wanted new clothes and we didn't want to wear the same clothes to, you know, so me and my sister, we would invite our friends and we'd tell everybody, bring 3 bags of your favorite clothes. Don't bring trash. Don't bring rubbish, because nobody wants trash. So bring your best clothes and we'll do swapsies, you know, and you negotiate with the other person, like how long can they have it for? Is it 2 weeks? Is it 3 weeks? And then you swap around, you know.
Wow.
So we were always encouraged as children to try, never fear failure. And we were always enabled, however crazy the idea was. And, you know, and I think my mom would have an even better insight in that, because my memory is probably, it's affected by what I remember as a child, but I think her and as an adult would remember a lot more of that.
Right.
And I think that when I look back at that, I think that is the absolute core and foundation of the way I see life, of the way I approach business, of the way I approach every opportunity within the business. There's just no fear in failure.
Right. And I think I now learn that, you know, one of the things that I really admire you about is your humility.
There are
very few founders who actually come across as people you can connect with. And I think your growing up days is kind of has led to this, right? So you're pretty grounded and you're always there to kind of help and support.
Thank you.
I think, and that means a lot to us, right? So I think I'll just go back to the childhood days a bit more. So what is the education system like in Lithuania then? What did you study? Do you remember yourself?
And this is, okay, so this was one of, I mean, when I tell you the story about going to protest against in front of the Minister of Foreign, Minister of Education, it was to do with the food. There was not enough choice, you know.
Right.
But I was always dissatisfied. I mean, and this is a while back, so the education system has changed and they reformed and they improved. But that back then, when I was in Lithuanian education system as a child, I didn't feel inspired. You know, we were never asked, we were not allowed to ask a question, why? It was always just, this is because it is that way. You have to learn it by heart. You're not allowed to question things. The teachers would solve a mathematical problem for you in one way, and there's the only way to do it. And if you try to say, well, what if we did it that way? Even if it's wrong, you know, the teacher should encourage you to explore it to arrive at the answer that isn't correct.
Right.
But we were always shut down. We were never encouraged to think for ourselves and think outside the box. You know, I'll give you, I studied humanities as a university. So, I mean, I was okay with maths, physics, chemistry, but it was never the thing that really floated my boat. So I always leaned towards humanities. So, you know, as an example, studying history in Lithuania, you were told to learn names, dates, and who did what, and that was it. You know, you were not encouraged to read other literature. You were not encouraged to read different opinions that challenged that. And when I moved to the UK, and again, I studied history at A-levels, in the first lesson. I mean, it was very different. You were told and insisted to have your own opinion. And if you are to study history, you have to have your own opinion. And just because there are two schools of thought in anything, in yes. anything in life, it doesn't mean that there can't be a third one or the fourth one or the fifth one. You may not be the most popular opinion, but if you can back up your point and validate it, you should be heard. So I never enjoyed studying in Lithuania. I was a straight A student, you know, and I went to a really great school where being academically successful made you a popular child
right.
or a teenager in school. So it wasn't one of those mean girls from American movies, you know. I actually went to a really good school. And if the better you did academically, the more popular you were amongst your peers, amongst different year groups. And we had a lot of different things happening, like debating society and drama. And so you could get involved with a lot of different things. And, you know, I look at the people I went to school with and where they have got to. And I kind of go, well, that was probably a really good school because everybody achieved and everybody's successful and everybody's interesting. You know, they didn't create robots, my school. But the education system in itself, I think, was very flawed and very old-fashioned and didn't keep up with what we needed as children. And I think that was one of the reasons why I decided to leave Lithuania and go and study abroad, because I felt that I will not actually learn anything.
Right.
I will be told information and I will regurgitate it.
Right.
You know, the way the exam system is done, I remember I left at 16 and I did my A-levels in the UK. And obviously I would go back to Lithuania often and I'm still friends with all the people I went to school with. And when at the age of 18, when you're finishing high school, when they were taking their exams, they were so stressed out. I mean, every single one of them, even the smartest kid, they were so stressed out because they knew that they have to input so much information into their head and regurgitate it in a way that the examiner will literally score points to them.
Right.
Right?
Wow.
And for me, being in the UK, I studied history, politics, Russian language and literature and psychology. So very humanities. But my exams were very different. You know, I was encouraged in the lead up to the exams to learn, to read, to put my point forward. I wasn't being marked down in my exams if I didn't agree with one of the two schools of thought. As long as I could argue my case well enough in my exams, I was going to get an A star.
Right.
And actually, I'm probably going to be one of the interesting essays the examiner is going to read that wasn't just the same as the others. And that was to be encouraged, you know. And I did not feel stressed out at all going into my final exams at the end of kind of college or high school, you know.
Right.
I remember actually, because you are collecting marks throughout your 2 years while you are studying. By the time I was going into my final exams, all I had to do was not fail to get A stars because I did so well throughout the 2 years, you know. So I think I think that was definitely a big factor why I wanted to leave Lithuania. And again, I carried that understanding with me throughout my adult years and professional career, because I feel like, you know, even in the most mundane kind of admin focused roles that we have at Drink Dry, where people come in, their job is to process orders, it's very the same every day, monotonous. They have to be very accurate, they have to be very good, but it's the same for them all the time. If I don't encourage those people to step out of their comfort zone every 6 months, if I don't review their performance, you know, and take them out of their comfort zone, somebody who maybe naturally isn't customer facing, they're very behind the computer, they're great behind emails and written and processing orders. But, you know, after a year with a company or 2 years with a company, what's next for them? They are young, they're 20s, 30s. What's next? You know, how are they going to progress in their career? So I push them out of their comfort zone and I'm saying, well, look, dude, we're going to split your time now 50-50. You're going to continue doing what you're doing. That's great. But 50% of the time, you're now going to be customer facing and or even customer speaking on the phone with B2C customers. You're very comfortable with B2B because It's all emails.
It's all email,
and
right?
You know, it's very simple.
Yeah.
But actually, we're going to put you in charge of a customer service phone line where people come and say, I placed an order an hour ago. It's not here. And you have to explain to them, well our promise is 4 hours, but I want it now, you know. And you have to learn to navigate. And they are petrified of it. They are absolutely petrified. But if you don't push them out of that comfort zone.
Yes.
I always say to myself, if somebody leaves my company in 5 years' time, what have they learned being with us? If they've come as one role, they've had salary increases in line with, you know, 5%, 4% that everybody gets every year, and they leave in 5 years in the same position, maybe just added senior before their title because they've been there 5 years, I've given them nothing. I have given them absolutely nothing. What I want people to do, because people will leave eventually, you know, and I want them to leave for them. I don't want them to leave for me because it's a pain.
Yeah.
But for them, I do eventually. You know, if I'm not giving them enough progression and they get a better opportunity somewhere else, you go. I will always support that. And if people leave, which we haven't yet because we're only 5 years old as a company, so we've not had that kind of
cycle of change.
We've not had that cycle. But when we do, you know, I want people to leave and say to me, you know, I'm going in a I came in as admin, I'm going into marketing. Yeah. Or I came in as marketing, I'm going in sales. Or I came in as sales, I'm going as head of operations. That will make me happy and proud that they had the opportunity to learn so much with us.
Yes.
That they can completely pivot in their thing. So, and this is, I think, a lot of these things, like I kept mentioning a few times on this podcast, but I'm starting to connect the dots. My thought process as somebody who runs the business, somebody who started the business, I'm connecting the dots to my childhood, to my early university days. I'm connecting the dots where it all came from, you know, to these experiences, whether it's input from my parents and the way I always saw them hustling, you know.
Yes.
Whether it's the education system that I saw, whether it's the people I met, you know, the friends that I made in university, for example, in the 3 years I was there, were absolutely critical. And I learned so much from each one of them.
Right.
Different nationalities, different financial backgrounds, different educational backgrounds, you know. And again, when I look at my team, we're a team of 17 people with 12 different nationalities. 17 people, 12 different, it's mind-blowing.
You're like a mini Dubai.
It's mind-blowing, right?
Yeah.
But we are so great as a team. Because we have so many different varied skill sets. And by now, we know who's acing that thing, who's acing that thing. And we can go, well, no, you do that. Because that suits you. You know how to do that.
Right.
Oh, I'll pick this up because I'm so much better at it, you know. Yeah. But I learned that in my friendship group when I was at university. We had somebody from Nepal. We had somebody from the UK. We had an Eastern European. We had a Russian girl. We had somebody from really old English money. We had somebody from, you know, East London whose parents were kind of like new money and very white boy. And and I learned that being in a diverse friendship group, we actually learned so much from another because we would go and spend summers in different places. We would learn different hobbies through one another. Somebody did polo. And somebody did golf. And somebody played poker in their basement. You know, so I'm starting to connect the dots a lot from where I am today to where all these things came from.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I think that's exactly the purpose that we wanted to actually figure out, right? What was the influence of your childhood on what you're doing today? Because a lot of our podcast listeners are young professionals now who are looking at how they want to build. And a lot of the times, the question that comes to me, I keep telling them, what's your core? And so there's an amplification that happens when you get success, right? Or for that matter, any high. If whatever's your core, you start doing more of that. So if you're a kind person and you become successful, you become kinder.
Yes.
And if you were a miser and you got a lot of money, you become even more miserly, right?
So agree.
It amplifies. So I think that's where I'm now connecting the dots and also saying, this is why Erica is so grounded. This is why she's so humble.
Thank you.
This is why she has this massively transformative purpose. Again, going back to your company, right? To people who work with you. And when they leave, they want to leave on a good note and for doing something better, right? Becoming better professionals. Great, great inputs, I think. If we move to the next segment, which is more about the business side of things, right? So you move from the UK.
This is where I know nothing about.
Again, humility. I'm sure you're calling the shots on everything that happens in the organization, including tasting every product that comes into you.
Still, I mean, that's just fun. That is just fun. You know, I still do taste every product, but now I invite other people in my team to taste it as well. You know, so it's not just me now. No, I'm still part of it, but it's no longer just me, you know, making that decision.
And they've now acquired the skills to give feedback on taste. Right?
Absolutely. So, I mean, people... I think there's a misconception that people think you have to acquire skills. I disagree with that. Yes, some professional skills, like in the nitty-gritty details of your job.
Right.
Yes. But I think as a whole, we all possess these skills. We need to polish them up. We need to bring them to life. We need to trust ourselves. You know, when I say I taste every product, I have no WSET wine education. Like, I do not know anything about alcoholic wine.
Yeah.
The only thing I know is, do I like it or not?
Right.
This is it. So when I openly came and said 5 years ago, this is a non-alcoholic drinks marketplace, and I taste every single product that comes on here. It is based entirely on, I think, if I'm a consumer, would I buy this product a second time? That's the only criteria we kind of have from the marketplace. Is it so good that I would buy it the second time?
Right.
I might not be a beer connoisseur, you know, so I will then ask somebody who drinks beer. I'm like, this tastes nice, but as a beer drinker, would you buy this product the second time? It is my job to sell you that thing the first time by marketing, putting it in your face, all the digital touch points, blah, 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 blah. It's my job as a company, as Erica, to sell you it the first time.
Right.
But the product has to sell itself again and again and again and again. That's it. That's no longer my job. So the only criteria and the skill that I ask my team is, do you like it? Would you buy it the second time? If you're a salesperson, would you sell it to a customer happily? You know,
right.
if we said, okay, as a company, we're bringing that product into the market, and you had to go and sell it into your hotel partnerships, restaurants, retailers, like, how would it make you feel? They're like, I'd love it. Like, I'd be so it's amazing because of this, the calories, the pricing, the story, da 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 da. I'm like, great. Yeah. Sales done.
Yeah.
Marketing. Would this product inspire you to be creative and marketing? And they'd be like, you know, I do like it, but they don't have any brand assets. There's no clear marketing story. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. I'm like, okay, great. So it's from within, as a marketeer, is it easy for you to market it? Or they might say, absolutely. I mean, look at it. It markets itself, you know. Supply chain. It's coming from, I don't know, Kazakhstan. Do we ship anything from Kazakhstan? Like, how difficult is it for you now? We ship containers upon containers from the UK. So if we're bringing a product from the UK, it's easy peasy lemon squeezy. Like, it's so easy. We know the compliance, we know the rules. We've got the corridor set up.
Right.
You know, so I say supply chain, how easy is it for you? I don't know, not easy. Easy, oh yeah, our agents can do that, easy peasy. So you have to ask each person individually from their perspective. And they know these skills. So there's no skills to be acquired. I'm not asking my team to give me the smell, the taste, I smell apple crumble with, I mean, a load of nonsense, you know? Right. It's, do you like the product? And does it make you happy as a consumer? That's it.
As simple as that.
As simple as that. Amazing. And so, therefore, I think everybody has all the skills required, you know? They just need to be confident in harnessing it and trusting yourself and trusting your instincts and your guts and everything else that they have.
Amazing. That's a new thing I learned today. I'm going to now use it too. I think a lot of us talk to you about your business, and we usually take Drink Dry as direct competition to alcohol, right? But there's also this large lobby of cola, beverages, etc., right? You're also in that space.
Yes.
When you started off, how easy was it, or how difficult rather was it for you to kind of find shelf space with partners who were always going to give the advertising money that?
Well, look, good question. And I think there were some hard lessons to be learned in there. I think in general, when the category of non-alc started, the category itself positioned itself as next to the alcoholic beverages. And therefore, it was competing with alcohol or coming in as a replacement for that. As the category matured and it became global, we've all learned, people who are in that category, that actually it sits in between the soft drinks and alcohol. You know, it's a category on its own, neither here nor there. It's in the middle. It's independent. It's a whole new vertical that you can tap into. So in the UAE, it was in terms of, so drink trying, we have e-commerce, hospitality and retail. E-commerce, we control it. We have our own marketplace. So, you know, we give it as much or as little airtime as we want to, because it's our own marketplace. How much money we can afford to put behind marketing, paid media, that's how much we can push it forward, right? When it comes to hospitality, we did make a mistake. And I don't think it was a mistake at that point, because we used the information that we had at that time and we made a decision. So it wasn't a mistake that we made. It was a learning. We wanted to tap into the alcohol occasion. So we would want to tap into the 20% of the alcohol consumption kind of in the evening where people go out, instead of trying to tap into the lunchtime occasion. What are those occasions where people are having a soft drinks? Why don't we try to, because it felt, people had this idea that if I'm going from alcohol to non-alcohol, I'm downgrading. Like, yes. I'm downgrading my choice, yes. Right? And it's very difficult to educate people on that initial instinct. You can tell them all about the product, that it's actually better quality, blah, blah, blah. But the initial, the social, the cultural is, I'm downgrading. I'm having something less than.
Yes.
Okay? And that's really difficult. And we were struggling to really crack hospitality in a meaningful way. When we shifted our focus on, okay, you know, let's have our drinks available in the evening, and if somebody wants to swap alcohol for non-alc, it's up to them. But we're going to focus our efforts into making people feel like they are upgrading,
yes,
from a soft drink. And all of a sudden, the conversation changed.
Changed, right.
People's perception changed, you know. Nobody wants to have, really, with a really nice meal, a boring glass of pop or soft drink, whether it's Coke or orange juice. People want equally as complex, sophisticated drinks as they have with food. So we were upgrading something, and nobody was questioning the price point. You know, if a glass of Coke cost you 12 dirhams, but a really nice non-alcoholic cocktail was costing you 25, nobody was saying anything. Like, yeah, I'll have that. And then they have another one because it has less sugar. They can physically, it's less calories, so they can drink it faster. So they probably drink that cocktail before the food even comes, and they're ordering a second and a third. And nobody was questioning the price point. When we were playing next to alcohol, they're like, but how is this the same price as alcohol? And it's only like 10% cheaper than alcoholic beverage. It doesn't feel fair, you know, because a glass of Coke is 10. Everything felt off. Like, we just weren't getting success. But when we shifted our focus and we were coming into place of soft drinks, upgrading, conversation entirely changed. And so e-commerce was where we started. Then we really focused on HoReCa, hotels, restaurants, on-premise consumption, where we started seeing good volumes and people were having great experience. Then retail was actual physical brick and mortar, grocery retailers was the final puzzle in our kind of thing that we were building. And we didn't launch with Spinneys and Waitrose, for example, until March 2024. We were working with Choitromes, with Grandiose, with GMG, and we had great success with them. But really, you know, in traditional grocery for premium products, Spinneys and Waitrose, where you need to be, right? Carrefour, certain hypermarkets where there's good footfall, where people go. But Spinneys and Waitrose, it's the right consumer. It's the right shopper for our products.
Right.
And we didn't launch with them until... and we've had conversations with them from 2020 until 2024, continuously. It wasn't the time. It wasn't the focus. Multiple reasons, right? And when we were able to go to them and say, well, look, we're seeing the success in hospitality where people are upgrading it. Let's create a whole new category within your supermarket. So instead of putting a Heineken Zero next to a Pepsi, because where else do you put it? Like, you have three products in the category, but you don't have the category itself here. So where do you put it? Oh, I'll just put it there. Oh, I'll put it there.
Yeah.
You know, It made no sense that consumers couldn't instinctively find it. There was no education about it. And what we have now done with Spinneys and Waitrose, Drinkjoy is actually, they're officially appointed category manager for non-alcoholic. So any supplier, any distributor even based here, if they want to supply Spinneys and Waitrose with a non-premium non-alcoholic drinks, they come via us. And we, together with, and we act completely independent on that. You know, we don't prioritize our brands over a new brand. We look at it very holistically. A new spirit brand. Do we need one? Does the category need one?
Yes.
What's the rotation? You know, maybe we do. If it's a great non-alcoholic beer, do we need it? What's the price point? You know, there's no point putting something that is the same as something exists to just cannibalize on existing sales.
Right.
So you have to be very strategic to expand the category in a way that it will actually expand the value of the category, right?
Right.
And this is what we eventually kind of sold into the retailer. Give us that responsibility. Yeah. You don't have to do it. We take on that headache. We have experience. We know how to do it. We can leverage the experience we had in hospitality, in e-commerce. We have a lot of insights digitally. We know who the shoppers are. We know their age. We know that we have this information that we can use. We won't always get it right, but it's better than what you guys are doing at the moment.
Right.
And it'll be like a hell of a lot better.
Yeah.
So there were always challenges and pushbacks. And I think it's you have to really listen to the pushback and why somebody's pushing back. If you go into any meeting thing, well, this is my objective and I'm getting that or else, you're going to lose.
You've already closed the door.
You close the door. I mean, you have to go in with a proposition, because if you go in, it's like, hey, how's it going, dude? So should we chat now? You know, it's not going to get anywhere, because you need to go and say, this is my vision. This is what I want from you. And this is what I want to do for you.
Yes.
But I'm open to your suggestions.
Yes.
Give me your objections to what I said.
Yes.
This doesn't work. This doesn't work. That's my problem. Expiry is my problem. Da, da, da. Give me everything. I want your problems.
Yes.
And then I go away. I go, aha, this is my thinking. These are his problems. How do I address his problems and make them go away in my final proposal to him?
Right.
Right. So if I go to them, I'll give you an example. We went to Spinneys and Waitrose and said, we want to give you a full category. We want spirits, we want wines, we want beers. We want you to have a whole aisle of non-alcoholic drinks, like you have with soft drinks, you know? Let's start with 3-4 meters and then we'll get to it. And then one of the objections was, you know, the non-alcoholic spirits don't really have a good enough rotation on shelf, because at the price point of 100, 120 dirhams, it stops being an impulse purchase. People don't know how to mix it. They are, do I spend 120 dirhams and then I have to mix it? Even if they buy it, they don't drink it fast enough at home, because there's at least 15, 10, 20 servings in a bottle, right?
Right.
It has, for consumer, it has to be consumed within a month of opening. It doesn't move. Yes, it creates a beautiful display and it creates a category feeling, but logistically speaking, for a retailer, it's dead space. Like, they're not capitalizing on that space, right? So we listen to it. And then we go away and we're like, and then there's expiry problems, et cetera, et cetera. So we're like, okay, no problem. We will rotate every 3 months. I'll give you fresh stock, because I sell so much of it in hospitality that for me, it's no problem selling something with 3 months left on the expiry, because they use it within the same week.
Mm-hmm.
So we will give it to you. We'll do sampling, right? We'll do sampling. We will invest in lots of other things. So we come with a solution why they should have it. Because the end goal is to have the category, right?
Yes.
And they're like, okay, maybe we will have not 4 facings of the product, but just 2. So we can minimize that kind of commercial dead space that you're talking about. So always listen to their objections. What are their problems? And then give them solutions. So if you go, well, I've sorted that out for you. And you must see that in tech, right?
Oh, yes,
the same thing. We're like, that's your problem. There's your solution. Problem, solution, problem, solution. And then they go, done. Okay, done deal. You can have the contract. You can do it, because you can solve it for them. So I think, and that is probably transferable across technology, across retail, across F&B, across all of it.
Yeah, I think that was the masterclass in how to create a category, right? So I think one of the additional avenues for people to listen to us, right? So I think great. Thank you very much for that, Erica. I think from going back to the alcohol conversation, there's a whole culture of music plus alcohol consumption, right? That's been entrenched largely beyond just, social drinking. How do you see that changing over the next, 10 years or so? Do you see that non-alcoholic drinks consumption is going to kind of make large inroads there, or is that going to...
Look, I think there's always... if you look at the data globally, alcohol consumption in certain parts of the world are in decline, Europe being a prime example. Beer is in decline, wine is in decline. Spirits are not yet in decline, but they stopped growing exponentially. The spirit growth is now, they're still growing, but 3%, 4%, when they used to grow 40%, right? So that in itself is a decline.
Right.
So in these different geographical pockets where I think the consumers are probably, they're developed markets, right? There's already a decline. Globally, the alcohol manufacturers, distributors, probably are not yet, if you take it as a whole pie, there isn't an alarm bell yet, because other emerging markets are over-consuming, right? They are over-consuming, so they're making up for that shortfall in other markets.
Right.
But my prediction would be that with alcohol, that overall it will be in decline. And they're getting on board with it. They're understanding it. So what they're trying to do, they are now recruiting all those non-drinking consumers that are coming up through new generations into their alcoholic brands. So think of a brand, Guinness, right? Huge brand equity, huge association with the brand. It's centuries of building the brand equity, and it's so solid. If Diageo hadn't launched Guinness 0.0, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, they just lose consumers.
Right.
Whereas by launching something fantastic quality, fantastic liquid in a 0.0, yes, the alcoholic one may come in decline, but the non-alc will grow. And overall, they're fine.
Right.
Right? So they're not losing the consumer. There's still consumer relationship with the brand. They're not losing consumers of their brand. They're just splitting it into alc and non-alc,
Right.
So there's always going to be a time and a place for alcohol. And there are new rituals and new occasions being created for non-alc. And it's still emerging and it's still being created. And I think for the marketeers in beverage industry in general, if I was a marketeer, but a real one that has a passion for it, I would be loving life right now. Because in alcohol, everything is done.
Okay.
Like you're not really creating, you're just executing of what the previous people have done it. You maybe get it, making it a little bit better, a bit more creative, but you're not creating anything new. You're not creating new rituals. You're not creating new occasions. You're not creating anything new. You're not creating new brands. But in non-alc, you are.
Right.
So I think, if I was a marketeer in beverage industry, I'd be like, this is it. This is why I want to get stuck in, because I can make a legacy. We all think of Aperol Spritz. We know the occasion. We know it's orange. We all see it. We know the occasion. It's aperitivo. These are the marketeers that created it. If you're a marketeer and you're going into the non-alc, you could create something that is synonymous with something.
Right.
In general, in the generations to come.
Right.
So there's always going to be a place and a time for alcohol and non-alc. And non-alc will find its way through these new rituals and new occasions into music festivals. It already has found its way into fine dining.
Right.
It already has found way into people's day-to-day. And actually, it first came into people's day-to-day. And that Monday to Friday occasion where people were previously consuming wine, a glass of wine, maybe two with dinner, non-alc came in and replaced that. And everybody's like, wow, I'm so much more efficient. I feel better. A no-brainer.
Right.
Absolute no-brainer. Monday to Friday, I'm now drinking non-alcoholic. Sometimes maybe having a glass of wine, but on the whole, I'm drinking non-alcoholic. And then I'll still go out and enjoy really nice alcoholic beverages in my fine dining experiences. And then over the time, non-alc found its way into fine dining.
Right.
And now you go into a fine dining restaurant and go, oh, do I want to drink alcohol today or not? Maybe not. Maybe yes.
Right.
And you have an option, right? It will find its way. High energy places, music festivals, nightclubs, they probably require some sort of boosters.
Yes.
Right? And alcohol is one of them initially. But the whole culture of high energy places is in decline.
Right.
Nightclubs are in decline. They're not surviving. How many nightclubs are left in Dubai?
Oh, yeah.
How many nightclubs are actually like successful in London now?
Right.
So high energy places are in decline. I think we will see really nice harmony between alcohol and non-alc. I would never go as far as to say alcohol will disappear.
Right. No, of course.
Never. Yeah, it won't. Never. And it will probably, like anything, it might go in decline for some time and then it'll plateau again. It'll find a new norm.
Right.
You know, and then non-alc will come in. And currently, the growth that everybody's talking about in non-alc is incredible. Like if I said to you, our spirits category, non-alcoholic spirits category within drink dry in 2024 grew by 2,564%.
Wow.
You go, wow.
What?
But we're starting from a low base.
Yes.
So like, it's impressive.
Yeah.
But like, you know, if I gave you value and value and quantity, it becomes less impressive.
Yeah.
The percentage is more impressive. So
right.
When everybody's reporting these insane figures, and it's great because it assures the market for non-alc and
yes.
its existence and its need, but we're starting from low base. And over the next decade or two, again, it'll find its own plateau and then we'll go into just a single digit growth.
Right.
You know, maybe double digit and then single digit and then it'll plateau. And maybe there'll be a new subcategory that will come in that allow it to boost, and then it'll plateau again, you know?
Right.
I think it will find its way to sit alongside one another really nicely.
Right. I think talking about variants, there's one quick question on that one. There's a lot of probiotic, postbiotic things getting added to variants right now. How do you see any play for that? In
massively, okay. Massively. I think we're just behind in this market on that. And as drink dry, we are ready to do it when the market is ready. And, you know, it's my job. I'm less involved now with the day-to-day operations. I have a fantastic senior management team. I have a fantastic MD who runs the business on a day-to-day basis. My job is to make sure that I see where the our market is going and what products will be required in the next 3 years, 5 years, that we are always the first one to launch it.
Right.
So what you are referring to is functional beverages,
yes, functional.
Right? So the way, again, non-alc kind of grew was you have something that is without, so it's non-alcoholic, it's without alcohol.
Yes.
It's and all these slogans people are using, better without, you know,
yes.
da 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 da. And we've now moved to open to more. Added, like it's
yes.
not without, it's more,
right?
And I think that's where the functional beverages are now coming into play, where yes, we have the basic non-alc, but let's add something good into it. Let's make it functional, whether it's post-workout, whether it's added protein, whether it's added, you know, anything else. I think here in this particular market, we're not ready for it yet. We are still educating consumers on the fact that Guinness 0.0, it's as good or better than the original variant,
right?
Once we crack that, we will be looking at functional.
And functional.
And we're already having conversations with the retailers, you know, we're pitching products to them, we're getting them to think, because like anything, you know, if you are buying a car and you go and you test drive a BMW X5 and you go, I'm going to think for a week, all you see on the road is X5s.
It's X5s.
Right? So
yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, you're
so
right.
So when I start pitching something to retailers,
yeah,
functional beverages, all they now see is functional beverages everywhere.
Right.
And they will come to it. And yeah. I just need to keep feeding them that information. They will come to me and say, I'm ready. I'm like, and here's your portfolio.
Right.
I need to be them ready to present to them immediately
right.
on the spot. The same with hospitality. You know, my salespeople are going out and they're like, they're feeding functional to people. And all of a sudden, in 3 months' time, they go back like, you know, it's so funny. We talked about functional beverages. And then I read this report. I mean, it's much bigger, right?
Yeah.
So you're feeding people this information. This is our job as market leaders to
right.
be leading that conversation.
Right.
We don't want to just be stuck in what we're doing now.
Right.
Like, what we're doing now for me is past.
Right.
That's it. I am mentally, I'm no longer in today.
Right.
You know, I will sit on the day that we launch Guinness 0.0, I will sit in a podcast or on a radio station and telling, you know, we've just launched Guinness 0.0 on Drink Dry Store. For me, that's old news.
Right.
Because this is nine months, 12 months, 2 years conversations.
Work already.
This
yeah.
is old news.
Yes.
I probably haven't even been involved with the brand now for 6 months.
Right.
Because my marketing team took it over, the supply chain took it over. It's just, this is just culminated.
Right.
So for me, it's old. And right. this is should always be for any business. Today is the past.
Yes.
Where are you in 3 years' time as a business? What is your portfolio? You know, and you have to change it. You know, I have conversations with the brands in Functional Beverage where I say, I think 2025 will launch you, right? And then 2025 comes, I'm like, we're not there yet.
We're not there
you
yet.
Know, but yeah. let's keep on seeing. Come and see us again. And you keep those conversations. And then maybe it won't be till 2027. I don't know. But you keep having those conversations. And smart brands and smart players understand it.
Yes.
You know, if you go fast, you might burn.
Right.
So you have to go slow and steady and just strike it at the right time.
Right.
You know, if you miss the opportunity, you miss the opportunity. You're no longer market leader. You don't get that first mover's advantage. You don't get to take that market share while nobody's watching. So timing is critical.
Right.
But you also can't go too early.
Right.
Because you'll waste your resources on something that just isn't ready for you.
Right.
You know, and you must see the same in technology.
In technology,
as well.
Absolutely. And that's my next question. I was coming into technology, right? So the same principles apply to technology as well. And in my learnings, businesses really scale when they apply the right technologies.
Correct.
What's been your experience with technologies that you've used from your starting days until?
Yeah. Look, I come from, I mean, even business and drinks and beverages is so alien to me. Like, I learn it as I go. You know, right. maybe I'm a quick learner, good for me, but I learn it as I go. Technology is like so alien to me. So I always know that if I'm not good at something, I need to work with somebody who's so much better than me, so much better. So at Drink Dry, and you'll probably, you've heard me say this in other meetings that we've had, we work with an external party. So we work with Emas Consulting,
right.
have done from day dot.
Right.
Even before the market knew of Drink Dry, Emas knew of Drink Dry a year before that because right. they helped to scale and build and everything else.
Right.
So we work with professionals in that field because my knowledge is non-alcoholic, like what I've just said to you.
Right.
I'm 3 years ahead, right? Technology is not one of them.
Right.
I don't know where AI is going to be in 3 years' time. Maybe I know where it's going to be in 6 months at
right.
best, but I don't know where it's going to be in three years' time.
Right.
My marketing people, you know, they also know how to do things here and now. Technology is not something we live and breathe, and we shouldn't because we're
right.
not a tech company.
Right.
So we work with intermediate people between us as a customer and technology providers, multiple of them. Because again, I don't have the time to scan every single one of them. I don't know. I don't know what I don't know. So we work with a company in between us who will say to us, now is the time we invest in X. Now is the time we invest in Y.
Right.
And we follow their lead, right? So we're forever. So as a business, you know, we are always investing in technology, not in building it, but like, what are we using
utilizing
now? Absolutely,
right.
you know.
Right.
And we take advice from people who are better than us. So I think one of the biggest things that the most important things that we have done in the last 12 to 15 months as Drink Dry, we use data insights that we have within Drink Dry, and we use AI to give us the absolute crown jewel, what we're looking for when it comes to customer segmentation, customer preferences, customer needs.
Right.
So I'll give you an example. Right, we all know how brutal Meta is on return on ad spend.
Yes.
It's criminal. We all have to do it. We all hate it because it's not generating enough, but you have to do it for all the other reasons. But it's criminal, right? And as a business owner who's putting cash on the line, it hurts to see that. However well you segmented it, it hurts. Now, what we have done very successfully at Drink Dry, in this one example, we took all the information, 5 years of information that we have on our consumers, and we use technology to segment them and identify them into, you are going to buy this 100%. If I give you the right value add offer or a discount, we're not really a discount driven business, so we prefer to give our consumers value add,
right?
Experience, extra, rather than here's a straight discount. But if I put this product in front of you in the right way, you will buy it. So we've used technology to really, really, really be smart with the money we're spending on technically digital advertising.
Right.
So WhatsApp, you know, we have a huge database, but if I have an offer on Corona Zero, I send it to such a small, very carefully segmented consumer base now.
Yes.
That the conversion rate is 25.
Right.
You know, the return on what, not conversion, the return on what we spend is 25.
Right.
Show me another platform where you can do that. Can you do that on Meta?
No.
Hell no.
Yeah, you can't.
But we can do that.
Right.
So, you know, if when you look at it, you go, we're sending so many different things to so many different people. Yes, it's labor intensive in terms of just going through it, but AI does it for us. And we are being smart with our money. I'm not showing you anything that you're not interested in.
Right.
Okay, we can do better, but essentially I'm not showing you anything that you don't want.
Right.
So I make it very difficult for you to say no. And I think as a marketplace, that's something, there's many other things that we can do, but as a marketplace, that's something that we have really honed in, and we look at our consumers so personally, and we want to make sure that we are only showing you the products that we know you, and every now and again we'll show you something similar. Maybe we'll entice you to try it, but maybe not.
Right.
Maybe not.
True. Amazing. Thank you very much, Erica. I think we're almost to the end of our conversation, and probably switching back to the personal side of things, maybe some leadership nuggets. So quick questions around, you know, what keeps Erica going, right? Because I'm sure this gets starting. I've been in a conference with you where you were running high fever. You popped a few pills and then walked up to the stage. So what keeps Erica going?
I love what I do. Yeah. You know, it's, and you can't fake it. You either do or you don't. And if you don't love what you do, get out of it. You know, the lack of the next paycheck isn't going to kill you. I know people are so mortified of financial responsibilities. And I'm not saying quit your job tomorrow if you're listening to this, if you have family to support, etc. But don't be scared of discomfort, financial discomfort for time being, if required, to do what you love. Because genuinely, you know, I work Monday to Sunday, whatever I was required, because I love it. And I do not feel that I work at all. Nothing that I do feels like work. So if you love what you do, you'll spring out of bed on 4 hours sleep and be excited for the day. I think that's absolute critical and number one. And the second thing is, and people chuck this word around very easily, but authenticity. And I really, really mean that. Don't try to be authentic. Don't try to be authentic. Be authentic. Be you. You know, if whatever background you come from, I come from a really working class background. My parents were hustling. I have insane work ethic. You know, you will never take that away from me because I learned it from my parents. But if you come from a super privileged background where your parents are billionaires and you were handed over $100 million check to go and make your business, own it. Own it. Be the rich kid who had $100 million from his dad but made it into a $3 billion industry. Own whatever you are. Like, so be authentic. Don't listen to my story and be like, oh yeah, I need to be a bit more humble. I need to, you know, maybe like portray my story a bit differently. No, be who you are.
Wow.
If you don't have experience in what you are doing right now, own it. Go to people and say, oh my gosh, I have no idea what this is, but I really love it. Like, I get the buzz out of it. Can you teach me? You know, genuinely be authentic and never doubt what's on your mind, speak it. As long as it comes from the right place, you're not showing off, you're not pretending, you're not lying, you're not cheating, you're not doing anything. Just be authentic.
All right. Amazing. What's one book that every entrepreneur should read?
You know, oh my gosh, there's so many. The one that I'm reading currently, and it's more so for female entrepreneurs, and I think I do think there's still a long way for us to go globally where people get similar opportunities, whether you are male, female, whether it's your cultural background, whether it's your age. There's age discrimination against entrepreneurs. Somebody
right.
who starts a business at 55 is being discriminated against somebody who started a business at the perceived perfect age of 30.
Yes.
Who said an entrepreneur is a perfect age of 30? I don't know. Right. And a white male, probably, most likely. So there's a long way we still have to go to break those barriers. So my personal passion is how do we ensure that female entrepreneurs break their own barriers here first before they go into the external world and portray themselves higher than they think they are. So I'm currently reading a book by Sarah Dusek from EY Entrepreneurial Winning Women program, and it's phenomenal. You know, it's think bigger. I think it's called Think Bigger or Thinking Bigger. And it's something that I read time and time and time again. You know, I could pick up any chapter, any book, and just read it. It's just reinforcement. It helps me deal with my own self-doubt. It helps me deal with that little voice that sometimes says, but you don't look like a typical entrepreneur. You don't look like a typical CEO. You don't look like XYZ. You know, and then you go, oh, maybe I don't. Maybe I should be 6'7", white male, and have no children, and drive a Rolls Royce for everybody to take me seriously. But who said so?
Yeah.
You know, so it's for me, it's all about those things that help me deal with me and the self-doubt that I have to keep me getting better, to help me get it better.
Amazing. Last question for sure. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Oh gosh, I know this inside out, and I always say this, that business is personal. It was my old mentor who shared this with me. And it was just that one phrase that he said it to me once. And I actually saw him a few weeks ago for coffee. And we talked about this because he used it in a conversation that we had. I said, oh my gosh. I said, you know, this phrase that you use, I absolutely live and swear by, that business is personal, that people do business with people, that if you go in as your authentic self, it doesn't matter. You know, if I go into the biggest meeting of my life, I go in as me. I want to know if you have children. I want to know where you're from. I want to know, you know, is blue your favorite color because that's what you're wearing today? Are you nervous on this podcast?
Yes.
You know, are you nervous changing your career? I want to know you personally, right? So business is personal, and you cannot fail at doing business on a personal level.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Erica. If
pleasure.
Our listeners have to follow you, where do they follow you and where do they follow
Drink Dry?
So they
can find us on Instagram at Drink Dry Store. They can find us on LinkedIn at Drink Dry. And they can visit our website at drinkdrystore.com.
Amazing. It's been such a pleasure talking to you, Erica. Thank you so much. You've again stumped me with your humility and your candid conversations.
Thank you.
This means a lot to us and to the Retail Remix community as well. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
Thank you. I hope you really, really enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Stay tuned, subscribe, like, and press the bell icon to follow us. We will bring you more episodes very soon. Looking forward to more of them. Thank you very much for joining us today.